I also have to apologize for the sound quality of this recording, because we never actually intended to record the reading of the script, and so it was just that the cameraman, Len Gowing, of Revenge's Tragedy, came to the reading, and we had a video camera there, and so he just pulled it out and started filming the actors, but nobody actually had a microphone, so the audio quality is quite poor. I mean, I think it's good enough that you could take little bits and pop on the side, but certainly it wasn't as good as we would have done if we planned. Apologies for the poor.
You can certainly hear Derek.
But you did, yeah, hi, what voice. Yeah. Actually, though, I must say, although the other actors were reading the script for the first time, Derek had read the script a couple of times before reading. Anyway, my little piece is titled Directing the Jacobeans, but I'll get to that very quickly, because that's easy. I mean, directing the Jacobeans, it's like directing anything else. I mean, it's good stuff, you know, and as both Todd and Nicoletta have observed, I mean, what it's about is our lives. Nothing has changed. We would be foolish to imagine that in 400 years anything really changed, that human beings developed or went on to a more advanced stage in such a short time, if ever. So I really do believe that there's no difference between then and now. I'm interested in the Elizabethans and the Renaissance in Jacobean revenge drama because it seems very contemporary, because its poetry is some of the best, because it's some of the best writing in English, and certainly in English drama, and also because I feel there's a danger of it being lost, because as young people tend to get pushed more towards media studies and towards interaction with screens, and less interaction with the written word, there is a danger in a generation or so that we may lose the ability to actually read these plays and to understand them and to perform them. So I'm interested in this Jacobeans.net project, which is the creation of maybe as many as a dozen of these Renaissance plays, mostly revenge dramas, but some stuff by Johnson as well, some city comedies, because on DVD, you have the possibility, just as Nicoletta is doing with the website, of providing the text, of providing hyperlinks to the text, and of providing a context, which perhaps creates a greater degree of enjoyment and a greater degree of understanding than just seeing the thing cold in the cinema or on television without some sort of assistance. Because I really think it's important that we don't track these things, because I think it's the best. I think it's the best literature that we have in English. And I also have to keep on praising you, because I do think as well the disaster box on the timeline is really important, because these plays come out of a time of enormous political and social change and of disaster. What have we got? We've got political instability, we've got an epidemic of venereal disease, we've got rebellions at home and wars abroad, we've got plots, and we've got a fear of foreigners, and we've got a hostility to competing religions. In other words, it's exactly like now. And disasters form a part of our drama and form a part of our popular consciousness. At the same time, there are differences. When we were doing the Revenge's Tragedy, the actor who plays Vindici, a very talented actor from Manchester called Christopher Eccleston, and he'd been approached by theatre in Leeds to do a play. And he was thinking, do Revenges. You know, because I think they wanted to do something from the Renaissance. And they mentioned Hamlet. And he was thinking, no, I'd rather do Revenges. And I said, oh, why is that? And he goes, well, you know, Hamlet's a bit of a toff, and Vindici is a man of the people, you know. And I said, well, actually, Vindici really is the son of a discontented nobleman. You know, we've made him in our version, we've made him a proletarian character, but really he's actually of the same social class almost as Hamlet, or and slightly above Hieronymo in the social structure. So that put Chris off Revenge's Tragedy a little bit, and he went to Leeds and did Hamlet instead. But using the same costume. I think that what's interesting about Spanish tragedy, well, you know this much better than I do, is it's its existence as a prototype for both the modern revenge drama, a lot of Western literature, and in particular, the prototype of the hero who delays inexplicably. The hero knows what he must do, but finds reasons to postpone it. Which is why I just talked to you about the Hamlet, because of course Kyd is also the author of the missing original Hamlet play. Then he explored twice the same idea, especially in the Hamlet drama, of a hero who probably should take action if he's going to do so, but doesn't, but delays and causes a greater disaster for himself and for everyone around him as a result. And you can see that passive, delaying protagonist throughout all of our literature, all the English literature that we've grown up on. Ishmael and the crew in Moby Dick are like that. You know, they know that they're heading for a disaster, and yet they delay, and they allow Ahab to lead them into it. In a modern book like Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, the protagonist is the Kyd, but he is paralyzed, even though he's a man of violence, he's paralyzed into inaction in the presence of great evil. And he doesn't kill the judge until the very final page of the book. And in film, it's a very common protagonist, or it was for a while. If you think about Marlon Brando's film One-Eyed Jacks, he plays the Rio Kyd, the revenger, who comes to town determined to revenge himself against Dad Longworth, played by Carl Malden. But what does he do when he gets there? He waits. He spends an hour hanging around until the tables are turned, the surprise is lost, and he's almost killed. And his friends are killed as well. Or in Mifune, or in Kurosawa's film, Yojimbo, Toshiro Mifune's character, having arrived in a very corrupt town dominated by two sets of gangsters, and having decided the whole town would be better off if these gangs of gangsters were destroyed, he doesn't destroy them. He sits around and waits, and as a result, disaster ensues, both for him and for everybody else involved. So I think the idea of the inactive protagonist who observes, doubts, delays, doesn't take action, while evil is very active, is very present. Evil takes action in an evil world. In a way, that's perhaps the way that we all feel. That's the way that everyone in our society feels, because we feel we know something's wrong, but we don't feel that we have power enough to act. And so maybe that's why it's such a major theme in our literature, and not only our literature, but other literatures too. And maybe that's, and so I think Kyd, in a way, is creating that in, as he's inventing one of the first English language plays, he's also creating that protagonist, who's a very modern protagonist. I think there's also a propaganda aspect to drama and to literature, and that in certain ways, the Renaissance drama, depending on the playwright, supports the goals of the state. It depicts evil foreigners. It tends to support the divine right of kings. It tends to support the idea that we should leave to God what is God's, and leave to the king what is the king's, and not upset the succession. And in a way, I would sort of divide artists into those who believe that and those who don't. Artists who believe that, obviously Shakespeare believes that, and works very hard to create a consistent drama, almost entirely consistent drama, in which those who offend the succession, those who would kill the king, are not considered good characters. And in a more modern way, you could say that directors like Alan Parker, like Tony and Ridley Scott, like Anthony Minghella, create a fairly consistent body of work which supports the status quo. Then there are the subversive artists, and I think I put Kyd among the subversive artists, but also obviously Webster, Marlowe, the director of Johnny Hamlet, Buñuel, artists, subversive artists who suggest that maybe sometimes there is a case to be made for getting rid of a whole lot of them. So even though at the end of The White Devil, that awful kid is brought on to say, you know, let those who do bad things, you know, realize that they're, you know, they stand on crutches made of slender reeds, it's not very harsh. Whereas the wicked Lodovico's line, "I lent this night piece and it was my best," is a much better line, which you can remember. So there is an aspect to revenge drama which is also a moral aspect of it. I think that's the issue that we were talking about before. And that's why I actually think that our drama has become a little bit corrupted, because the idea of Elizabethan and Renaissance drama is that revenge is wrong. That taking personal revenge, which to a previous generation was a viable option, is no longer a viable option. It actually is something that one should not do. And so the revenger must be punished. And that's why even Vindici, who is a very, very exciting and entertaining revenger, has to die at the end, has to be dragged off to the torture, along with his innocent brother. The revenger must be punished. And when in a modern film, such as Death Wish, or a Bruce Willis film, or a Tarantino film, when the revenger gets away with it and isn't punished, something is destabilized. And we create a drama which, while entertaining, is fundamentally immoral and doesn't teach a lesson. And that leads to a confused society, and that leads ultimately to a society where foreign policy can be led by revenge, which leads to disastrous results. So I think that there is a really interesting moral aspect to revenge drama as well, which we don't want to lose sight of. So as we gradually make these DVDs of Renaissance dramas and turn them out, BMUP will release them, both on license to schools so they can watch them on their server on the television, but also sell them in bookshops and sell them abroad through their international distribution network. So that sounds to me like a very interesting prospect, but what I haven't been able to do is find a financier, not a private financier, not an academic financier, and certainly not the state itself, not Film Council, because paradoxically, when you present a play like the Spanish Tragedy to the Film Council, they say both that it's old-fashioned and that it's risky. So in a way, it's dangerous in two ways. It's dangerous because it's literature, but it's also dangerous because they don't know what to make of it, and because it tends to contradict the formulas that we're used to in terms of our entertainment now, in terms of our drama, our film-based revenge dramas. So what I would like to do is figure out a way, if anybody here can offer me any advice or any assistance, how do we get a production of Spanish Tragedy going? Now, obviously we'd like it to star Derek Jacobi, because he's a fantastic actor. But as you can see, it's a large cast, so then we have to pay those actors. So there must be some way, either of doing it professionally, with a professional cast starring Derek, or doing it with a cast of students here at the university, or of doing it in Murcia or in Valencia as part of one of your projects. There must be some way that we can pull this off, because I think that if there were a good production of Spanish Tragedy, that it would be a great educational tool. It would provide kids who are going to study this thing for A-level or AS-level or university, it would provide students and people interested in these dramas with a real point of entry to them and encourage the take-up of them. In the same way as people are very familiar with Shakespeare, thanks to the work Olivier and Mel Gibson and Kenneth Branagh and others. But the Jacobeans are missing this opportunity, and I don't want to see them disappear. I don't want to see them slip through the net and off the syllabus because there wasn't the money to mount a modest production. So any thoughts anybody can have, please email me or suggest some ideas. I enthusiastically cooperate. I think what's most likely to happen in terms of our Jacobean project, we're calling it Jacobeans.net, but obviously it stretches back to the Elizabethans and forward to four. We may make a production of Dr. Faustus for television. We have an executive producer called Trevor Eve, who is a popular television actor. He has a series about a fertility clinic. But also he was the producer of Twelfth Night, which was done by Channel 4 a few years ago. So he's a good person, I think, to be our front man for Dr. Faustus, in the hope that we'll be able to get a broadcast on board for that project. In the case of the White Devil, with a bit of luck, if not this year, then next year, I'm going to direct a production of the White Devil in Liverpool, either at the Everyman and the Playhouse, or possibly, or this would be very weird, possibly in Liverpool Cathedral, in the Anglican Cathedral, where the acoustics are very bad, but obviously the interior is spectacular. So, and both of those then could become part, would become part of the project. But anyone who has any thoughts on how we can make a decent production of the Spanish tragedy involving both real actors and puppets, let us know. Thank you. And any questions?
Yeah, what's the bottom line?
I don't know really. Because
but how much money are you looking for?
How many puppets? Are we going to make it with Derek, or are we going to make it with students? I would think if you were going to do it with actors, it would probably cost about £100,000 or $250,000, depending on how much you paid them, how long you took. I think working with actors, and this is partially the problem as well in terms of accessibility, because if you live in the south, if you're a student living in London or in the south of England, anywhere near Stratford-on-Avon, you can go and see a pretty good production of one of these things at the National, at the Barbican, at the Swan. But if you live up in, if you live somewhere else, you don't have the access, and so because the cast are large, and so it's expensive to mount a production, and it actually costs a lot to put a play on. Well, I was astonished how much it costs to put on a play at the Oxford Playhouse. I mean, they're talking about budgets of £150,000 to do quite a modest stage play. You know, so the plays aren't cheap. So we're talking about some, or else coming up with some clever route, We do it in some clever way so it doesn't cost so much. But I think we are looking at a minimum of £100,000. Nobody's got £100,000.
What other plays in the world are you planning to do?
I mean, it's flexible too, because it's anywhere between 8 and 12. But the ones that we thought we would do are The Changeling, Women Who Wear Women, Malfi and the White Devil, Revenges We've Done, Faustus, Spanish, and Volpone. Oh, and Tis Pity She's a Whore. But then we can expand beyond that a little bit, because then we start getting into these interesting areas like, is it worth doing the tragedy of Miriam versus playing English that we know are written by a woman? Is it worth doing Chettle's The Tragedy of Hoffman? You know, I mean, all of these, I mean, probably.
I'll get definitely.
I think it might be a very interesting play to do then, but it's not currently on the syllabus. Mm-hmm. Whereas other things like The Changeling, Women Who Wear Women, Malfi, Webster rotate through the GCSE and the A-level syllabus. But Spanish tragedy is going to appear on the on the syllabus, isn't it? So
it's very likely to appear since the White Devil is going to go and the Changeling is going to go, so it has to come up, and then it's always a matter of what's available. So checking the five examination and booklets for last year, that was my conclusion. Spanish tragedy is very likely to turn up.
I think it'd be very good because it'd obviously be very helpful to people studying Hamlet. You know, if they can study Hamlet and Spanish tragedy, it'd be fascinating. And I think also it's got like a conveyor belt too. I think there's the conveyor belt of Renaissance drama, and then it disappears, but it's just going to go around and come back again in 5 years' time. So I hope it's a long duration of things. And then what about Marston? What about Antonio's Revenge? And what, you know, there's other things. Bossy d'Amboise. And so, and it's so like, it would be very interesting to read the book talking about the Jacobeans and the modern cinema, because there's so much in common between the Jacobeans, or Elizabethans, the Renaissance, and the Italian Western, in the sense of revenge theme, often ending with a tragic conclusion, but also the idea that in both cases, you've got artists in Britain and in Italy, taking a foreign environment so as to tell our local stories that they can't tell at home. And that's very interesting because obviously, I mean, you would have been locked up if you made Spanish tragedy or if you or Hamlet was set in the English court. So there's the necessity to base things far away.
You've made a spaghetti restaurant in Spain along the lines of Johnny Hamlet, and you've made Revengers. How is it the same and how is it different to be doing a spaghetti western and to be doing a Jacobean in the directing? And how you thought about it?
I think that I learned to be more attentive to the script. I think that when I made my spaghetti western, I sort of thought that you want to be really clever and kind of drop the script and make things up on set and what a plan and do other things instead. And I think by the time we made Revenge's Tragedy, I figured out that actually the script really is the most important thing in a way, because the script is everything. And that creates the formula for everything that follows. So I wouldn't necessarily be as improvisational now.
But was there any similarity in how you treated the themes? Or any differences?
I don't think that Spaghetti Western I made had any themes.
Well, if you were going to make a Spaghetti Western that had a theme, how would it differ or be the same? As if you were going to do, the Spanish Tragedy. How would you do all the blood and gore scenes?
Well, the interesting thing about spaghetti westerns is they actually aren't very bloodthirsty. I mean, all manner of horrible things happen. But there's not. It isn't like watching a Tarantino film or a Capital film where there's lots of slow motion and people fly through and blood comes out and stuff. The spaghetti westerns are quite decorous in that way because what they do is they extend the moment prior to the violence. And the violence happens very quickly.
Just like Spanish Tragedy.
That's Spanish Tragedy. Spanish Tragedy isn't like an hour and a half of Horonimo Children's Tongue. Whereas the Tarantino version of Spanish Tragedy probably would be.
Because it's always been my contention that the reason why he's attracted to Jacobeans is because he was badly in love with spaghetti westerns when he was 12. Because they're the same, just as you pointed out. And I really think you're bringing the same sensibility to bear on the All Jacobeans project that you bring when you're looking at the spaghetti westerns. Come excitedly and tell me about some new angle in it, but some new way of torture that they have happening in this movie that you've never seen in another one.
There is a thing, spaghetti westerns, they do tend to do this thing where they put it out in the sun, they put hold your eye open with cocktail sticks, that kind of thing. But yeah, there's a lot in common. But also I think what interested me as well was the idea that a lot of the better spaghetti westerns, they really are political allegories about American intervention in Latin America or whatever, and they're being masquerading as cowboy films in order to get the point across.
Well, that's what you did with Avengers.
And that's what Avengers does, and that's what a lot of these do. A lot of the Renaissance.
I'm allowed to ask this question in my residual American accent. Is the golf course that you're imagining going to be somewhere in the vicinity of Washington, D.C.?
Could be, couldn't it?
It's going to be a green screen because we won't have the budget for a real golf course, but I think our idea also was that it would be very stylized in a funny way. You know, it would be like they're riding on a golf cart with a projection behind them of a golf course, racing around with them all, with the other guys running next to them. So it certainly could be the White House in the distance.
Well, what we did find making Revenge's Tragedy was that because we were shooting in Liverpool and wanted to take advantage of these great public buildings that were put in the 19th century, that it did become a little bit of a logistics exercise. You know, how do we, we have to shoot daytime scenes in the middle of the night and that kind of thing, in order to get access to the buildings. Mm-hmm. So we thought this time if we did them in a studio with a big green, cyclorama behind, so we could put in the backgrounds afterwards, that then we could concentrate more on the acting and the performance. And we wouldn't be asking Derek Jacobi and Diana Quick and Eddie Izzard and all these other very good actors to get up in the middle of the night to act. Because obviously people act better if they're concentrating and resting.
The two most terrifying words that a producer can hear are exterior night.
No, exterior night rain.
Well, were you filming Revenge at the same time as Don Boyd was doing his King Lear?
Right after. Yeah, I think he just finished.
He beat up some of the locations enough so that we could get them cheap, too. That's really good.
And I thought that in terms of the visual aspect of that film, it was, I mean, it was quite impressive, but I didn't really understand the motivation behind this sort of Joe Macbeth idea, you lose the language. Mm-hmm. Because especially King Lear, I mean, making King Lear, you're not going to do it in the original, mm-hmm. the original text. I mean, I'm sure Richard Harris could have handled it. Sure.
The same year he directed The Revenge of Stalin, there was a TV adaptation of King Lear in the United States, starring Patrick Stewart, titled King of Texas.
Really?
Yeah. And he has to divide, I mean, his kingdom between his daughters because his son died at El Alamo.
How interesting.
Yes.
That's great.
And there are several other westerns based on Shakespeare. I mean, Juba is a rewriting of Othello. And Broken Lemons is a rewriting of King Lear.
That's very interesting. Yeah. I've never heard of Patrick. That's interesting, Patrick Stewart, because we were talking about King Lear and Little Man.
That's fascinating. That's never been released outside the United States. But you can buy the link on videotape.
Maybe free copies, yeah, that sort of. There's kind of an international Shakespearean nerd quality. But that's a very interesting movie because it kind of begins as a Clinton film because the King Lear character becomes the defender of all the dispossessed, the Mexicans, all the Caribbean kind of people. But it ends up with this image of Edgar and his dad who survived. Standing, waiting, on guard, like Homeland Defense, waiting for some new threat to come over. So what's fascinating is how sometimes people come into it kind of knowing what they're going to say, typically, by using these kind of Shakespeare legends, if you like, and sometimes they don't really know what they're going to go into. They get shaped by the times, which is why I'm so fascinated that you were both working at the same time, but made such totally different movements.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I suppose that would come to a vote about us now.
Yeah. And I actually think, I mean, I like that Don Boyd. I mean, I like the visual aspect of it. And some of the actors are great, hence which they kept the original text. And you have the and then there's the whole Japanese Shakespeare camp, isn't there? There's all the Kurosawa adaptations of Shakespeare. The best of that.
And then Yojimbo was cremated to Western.
And then Yojimbo became a spaghetti western and created the prototype for all these films that came after. That's right. But it's really Yojimbo. And interestingly, Yojimbo and One-Eyed Jacks, the Brando film, were made almost at the same time. Both made in 1961, both with the delayed protagonist. But it seems to be gestalt rather than one filmmaker saw the other filmmaker's work. Because it doesn't seem, because I asked Japanese friends about this, if there was any possibility that Kurosawa had seen Brando's film, or vice versa. It doesn't sound like, it just sounds like us, like Don Boyd and us doing the two Shakespeare films in Liverpool at the same time. It was coincidence. Perhaps not entirely coincidence, but it's just something else.
Ten or 15 minutes, everybody seems to be thinking about the Spanish tragedy in relation to Westerns and spaghetti Westerns, and to me, the Spanish tragedy is a deep peak. Because if we make the effort of decentering Hieronymus and forget that the play is about Hieronymus, and we think about Andrea, El Imperial, Horatio, and Lorenzo, what we have here is a great teen pick. Think about this woman who has this boyfriend. The boyfriend gets killed, and then the chap that kills her boyfriend wants to make love to her and wants her to go out with him and marry him. And then she very quickly starts up a relationship with another one, Horatio, and she wants this new boyfriend to somehow revenge the old one, but at the same time she's manipulating the second boyfriend, and everybody thinks that it's horrible that she has started up this second relationship so quickly after the death of the other one, and then her brother comes and sides with the man that killed her boyfriend. Excellent.
But you have to let Horatio, if it's going to be a team pick, Horatio has to live all the way through, and then he and Belisario have to have to do.
I mean, I was thinking of this Spanish tragedy, I'm thinking about Romeo plus Juliet, and William Shakespeare, Romeo plus Juliet, plus Newman, rather than all, and I kept listening to all of you, thinking about Western and Western, and I was thinking about Romeo plus Juliet.
But it
occurred to me that this is something that could be done when you were all talking about King Lear as well, because King Lear is again a play in which you decenter Lear and think, wait a minute, this is not a play about Lear, it is a play about three sisters quarreling about money and inheritance. And then I sort of made the comparison to the Spanish tragedy. And the Spanish tragedy, if you forget about your own for a while, you could sort of look at it from the other angle and
so check them.
Well, there was a woman here today who had to leave, but she teaches GCSE and A level. She was saying said the same thing, didn't she? Which is that it is really about premarital sex. Mm-hmm. You know, and about a woman's or a young girl's right to pick her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. That's really true as well.
Well, there's an issue in the Elizabethan time because all they object to is class.
That's right. And it's not about having sex, it's about the class of the person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the morbid obsession of Lorenzo with his sister sexual life is very interesting. If I can, I'm going to try and come back tomorrow and hear what you guys have got to say.